Hi guys, my name is Andrew Davidson with AskForMyAbility.com. The other week I was having a conversation with a longtime female friend of mine who currently works the overnight shift in the deli section of a local grocery store. A conversation turned to the crazy things her fellow coworkers say as they sit around most nights unable to work due to a lack of immediate product to prepare. They sit around an oversized box that operates as a table, play cards, and get into some pretty wild discussions. The two other gentlemen my friend works with are a few decades older than her and are absolutely obsessed with conspiracy theories. In their mind's eye, they believe in everything shrouded in even a morsel of conspiracy. The Holocaust never happened. Lee Harvey Oswald had nothing to do with JFK. The moon landing was recorded in a studio somewhere in Hollywood. 9/11 was an inside job. Andy Kaufman faked his own death. Area 51 and aliens. The Illuminati. The West Virginia Mothman. Bigfoot. Sasquatch. You name it. They dig it. More specifically, they subject my friend, who has no strong feelings one way or another regarding these issues, to hours upon hours of delusional discourse. Eventually, she reports to me the latest bat crap crazy conversations observed during her overnight shifts. For those of you who haven't already guessed it, this episode of History and Game is an examination of an obscure yet fascinating conspiracy theory. Before we jump headfirst into the deep end of this thing, I'd like to briefly share my own experience. I first learned of this conspiracy theory many years ago while in undergrad school. Honestly, I paid it no mind, or perhaps I simply couldn't care less if it was real, fake, whatever. I'm not much of a conspiracy person, honestly. I don't believe in ghosts, aliens, or that Andy Kaufman is living in a small two-bedroom down the street from me. I'm boring like that, I guess. However, after doing research to prepare for this episode, I read a few books on the topic, watched a full-length, low-budget documentary, and even rented a big-budget Hollywood movie dramatizing the conspiracy theory and its salient points by renting it using my Amazon Prime account. After doing my due diligence and researching the topic, boy, I have got to say with a supermassive shrug, the diehard members who believe in the conspiracy make a really, really convincing argument. So what am I talking about exactly? In the world of literature, these folks created what's known as anti-Stratfordian theory. Anti-Stratfordian theory states that while a William Shakespeare did exist, he is not responsible for writing a single word of his plays, poems, and sonnet. Whether you were forced to study Romeo and Juliet in high school or take a survey course in college, you know of William Shakespeare. Everyone does. His body of work is so ubiquitous and baked into our culture that each and every individual has been exposed to the bard's influence. Like the incredibly popular World War II HBO miniseries, Band of Brothers, takes its name from an influential pre-battle speech in Henry V. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. The Netflix series House of Cards comes from Richard III. Sons of Anarchy is a direct allegory of Hamlet. The breakout hit show Lost by J.J. Abrams shares many, many similarities to The Tempest. Shakespeare has given us popular sayings and platitudes, too. I may remark to a friend who fell in love with the wrong person by saying that, quote, love is blind. Two lovebirds who cannot be together due to fate are, quote, star-crossed lovers. When meeting someone new, I may look for a way to, quote, break the ice. Someone who puts on weight due to their love for ice cream may say they've had, quote, too much of a good thing. Elbow room, the lady doth protest too much, every dog will have his day, fancy free, and it's all Greek to me, all from the works of Shakespeare. I even left out the biggest one of them all when the titular character from Hamlet questions committing suicide by saying, "To be or not to be, that is the question." So what's the big hullabaloo with these Stratfordians, eh? One of the books I read during my research is titled Players, The Mysterious Identity of William Shakespeare by Bertram Fields. Fields sums up the salient points in one page, which I'd like to quote from. Fields writes, "For centuries, scholars, other professionals, and amateurs have debated the true identity of the author of the magnificent body of poems and plays attributed to William Shakespeare. Most of the literate world thinks of the author as the bearded, balding man from Stratford-upon-Avon, and Stratford has become a prosperous tourist attraction and destination as the home of the great bard. Yet some very competent and credible people have questioned this, contending that the vast body of diverse knowledge demonstrably possessed by the author of Shakespeare's work was simply not available to William Shakespeare of Stratford, who had a grade school education at best, and appears to have had difficulty writing anything, including his own name. They argue that the wisdom and humanity expressed with such perception and elegance in the poems and plays cannot be reconciled with what we know about the crass and selfish behavior of the, quote, Stratford man. Henry James wrote that he was haunted by the conviction that the divine William is the biggest and most successful fraud ever practiced on a patient world. If the William Shakespeare from Stratford was not the true author, who was?" Okay, so riddle me this, Batman. How does an individual born of a poor glove maker who dropped out of the fourth grade, particularly illiterate, and spells his last name differently at the end of every manuscript, become one of the most iconic literary figures in the world? When he died in 1613, why does Shakespeare's will mention nothing of his plays or sonnets, his whole life's work? Instead, his final will and testament clearly states that he leaves his bed to his wife, Anne Hathaway. Huh, must have been some wicked awesome bed to inherit. Why is Shakespeare spelled differently on every single manuscript, and often appearing like the scribbling of a child and not the flowing cursive swoops and arcs of a sophisticated adult? How does a guy with barely any education understand Greek history and society to produce Antony and Cleopatra? How could he describe Venetian society in Othello, the Moor of Venice? Remember, this is before people can fudge it like I am doing right now by using Google or the local library. In fact, there weren't any public libraries in the 16th century, only a gathering of religious texts in a church basement with stone walls hidden from the public eye. The inconsistencies are everywhere, even down to what William Shakespeare looked like. So where did these beautiful plays come from? The prevailing opinion among conspiracy members is that the work was written by Edward de Vere, the Earl of Oxford. As much of Shakespeare's work provided social commentary, poking fun and disrespecting distinguished affluent men and women, the Earl of Oxford needed a man in the middle to conceal his identity and keep his reputation intact. This, ladies and gentlemen, is where our man and struggling actor from Stratford-upon-Avon stumbles on the scene. Edward would pass his work to William, who would then sign them and pass off the manuscripts as his own. This formulates the plot of the 2011 Hollywood film Anonymous, directed by Roland Emmerich. Shakespeare, or whoever the true Shakespeare was, wrote 154 sonnets. Sonnets 1 through 126 are written about a handsome and sought-after man referred to as the fair youth. The poems are often seen as being quite homoerotic in nature, which illustrates that whoever the real Shakespeare was, he was bisexual. The sonnets were never meant for publication. They were revealed posthumously. Also, the sonnets are dedicated to a Mr. W.H., who scholars debate over the identity of Mr. W.H. and the possibility of him being the fair youth. Now, there are about seven individuals in contention, and for the sake of time, I will not address them in this episode. Sonnets 127 through 152 make reference to a dark lady. Again, scholars have turned to the history books to find the identity of the dark lady. And again, there are six front runners of affluent women who fit the description and time period. Unfortunately, there cannot be any firm resolution as to the identity of the fair youth and the dark lady. But that has not stopped historians and literary scholars from debating back and forth, over who better fits the bill. What if there was a game where you could search for and discover the dark lady's identity yourself? Black Sonata, designed by John Keane and published by TGG Games, is a solo-only deduction and hidden movement game. The object of the game is to collect enough clues before running out of time to identify who William Shakespeare's Dark Lady is. The game progresses by you and the Dark Lady alternating turns. The Dark Lady moves in secret along a preset path determined by a stack of cards. Your job is to figure out where the Dark Lady is hiding on the board and confront her. If you're correct, then you get a clue as to the Dark Lady's true identity. Dark Ladies are represented on cards that you shuffle face down and select one, without peeking, to be the Dark Lady for your game. Black Sonata is a completely unique game, as it implements hidden movement without the need for a player. This is brilliant, absolutely brilliant. As already mentioned, the Dark Lady moves according to how a movement deck is stacked, and there are numerous ways to stack the deck so that she moves along a different path each game. You can even up the difficulty by stacking the deck in a manner where she doesn't move but appears to, or doubles back. The game is extremely quick to play, as all you're doing is taking one action on your turn, moving the Dark Lady, then repeat until you have a resolution. Black Sonata is an incredibly fun nut to crack. The deduction aspect alone appeals to the majority of gamers, even if they're not quite so keen on all the Shakespeare stuff. The game is not an easy one to beat. If you don't get discouraged by flat out losing your first few games, you will get there. For me, it took a few games on easy mode before cracking the case and winning the game, and I have yet to win on advanced mode. Being able to scale the difficulty to the player's preference is also a huge plus. The board is small, but it's functional. The card artwork is great. The tokens are functional. Honestly, the production value is high enough on this one to keep you coming back. And I can't say that about very many solitaire games I own. Unfortunately, like with any game, you will tire of playing Black Sonata, as is the case with me. However, I can still strongly recommend Black Sonata because there is plenty of game under the hood for the price. If you're looking for a quick, portable, solo game, I highly recommend Black Sonata. If you're looking for William Shakespeare's true identity, I highly recommend you search your local library and formulate your own opinion, as I welcome you to the biggest literary conspiracy the world has ever known. My name is Andrew Davidson. I hope I have given you something to think about.